Yes, thank you, Dr. Wegner, for inviting me to this meeting. Parameters for correct interpretation of Daniel 9, 24 to 27. As some or even many of you may know, an entire chapter of our work, Kingdom Through Covenant, is devoted to Daniel 9, 24 to 27. The chapter is actually an extensive revision of an article published previously in the Southern Journal. Since the publication in 2012, I have gained further insight on one or two issues, I think. I have benefited greatly from a couple of sources. First, Sam Storm's book, Kingdom Come, The Amillennial Alternative. Unfortunately, Sam did not use the revised treatment of my work, although he was given a copy of the book at publication. Second, an MDiv graduate of Providence Theological Seminary by the name of Zach Maxey has done important work on this text. So he's written an MDiv thesis on Daniel 9, which I think has some real value. And he has allowed me to use some slides he made, as his view is quite similar to my own. So in the PowerPoint presentation, some of the nicer slides are from him and some of the cruder ones are from me. I want to say up front that I have no personal stake in the exegesis of this text. I am not seeking to defend a particular system of theology, such as covenant theology or dispensationalism. My only desire is to understand the scriptures, and I am willing to change my views if exegesis based on the cultural setting, linguistic data, literary structures, and biblical meta-narrative as context can demonstrate a better interpretation. The title of this presentation is intentional. I have been doing serious work on the original text of Daniel 9 for 35 years. I am certain of some things and uncertain about others. So I feel I'm beginning to understand this text, but there are many things that I'm not sure about. What I want to lay down as a challenge to fellow scholars a number of things that are certain, virtually non-negotiable, and that create impossible obstacles for other views. I also want to discuss the things about which I am uncertain and looking for further insight and understanding. So I will try to cut off my remarks in time to hear what you might have to say. Literary structure. Most treatments of Daniel 9 do not pay sufficient attention to the literary structure of the book, to the place of Daniel 9 in the literary structure of the book, and to the literary structure of Daniel 9, 24 to 27 itself. Like the music that carries the lyrics, literary structure, in my judgment, carries half or even more than half of the meaning in the text. Without discussing clever chiasms, which I believe are there at a basic level, we have six stories and four visions. Is that focused properly? Okay.
Do it by hand if you need to, sir.
I don't know how to do it.
Just turn the lens.
Is that... okay. So, this is simply very straightforward. I think there are some clever chiastic structures in the book of Daniel. I think that it's possible for a literary work to have two different or more structures if they're not competing with the intention, the author's intention. The book of Daniel, as we see, consists of 12 chapters which divide equally into 6 narrative and 6 visionary chapters. In the Hebrew canon, Daniel follows the poetic section, which ends with Lamentations, a book focused on the theme of the exile. The narratives of chapters 1 to 6 in Daniel take up this theme of exile and describe how faith in the God of Israel, the one true and living God, is to be maintained in the face of defilement, idolatry, and prohibitions of prayer, backed up by wild beasts and fire and great persecution. The dreams and visions of chapters 7 to 12, apocalyptic in nature, give hope to the people of God by showing God in control of history through the 4 periods of domination by foreign nations until a decisive end is made to rebellion and sin, with a renewal of the broken covenant and restoration of the temple and establishment of God's kingdom as eternal and final. So I do take seriously the position of this book in the Hebrew canon. And that contributes to its meaning. The literary structures are the key to interpretation. We need a clear view of the whole in order to understand the parts and their relationship to each other. So when I look outside the window and ask you what you see a tree. You make a judgment about the whole. Then you can go and investigate the parts, what kind of roots it has, what kind of a trunk it has, how far it goes up before it branches, the shape of the branches, the shape of the leaves, the pattern on the leaves, if you stand there long enough, whether there's any fruit to be born, whether there are any flowers to be seen. You might make, then after an examination of the details, a refined statement about the whole. Or you might find, for example, that you've come to a wrong conclusion. So you might think you're looking at a beech tree, but you don't find any nuts at the right time of the year. That means you have to go back and revise your view of the whole. So I believe this is the way our minds work. We're always going back and forth between our view of the whole and our understanding of the parts. Our understanding of the parts, our understanding of the whole determines the view of the parts and vice versa. It is crucial to understand that the dream of chapter 2 and the vision of chapter 7 are at the center of the book and communicate in different ways the same thing. In chapter 2, a gigantic image of a man is front and center in the Babylonian king's dream. Its head consists of gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron and feet of iron and clay. It is struck down by a rock cut without hands from a mountain, which then grows to fill the entire earth. This dream foretells 4 successive human kingdoms succeeded by the kingdom of God, which will endure forever. Chapter 7 begins the second half of the book, in which the Babylonian king's dream is expanded in a series of visions presented like maps provided with blow-up inserts. This, I think, is crucial. So if you have, most of you don't use the Rand McNally Road Atlas anymore because you go to Google. But if you can remember such ancient history, you're looking at a map of a state, and in the corner there's a blow up of one of the major cities in that state that you're going to be passing through. And so Daniel 7, it gives us the overview, and then there's a blow up in chapter 8 that focuses more on telescoping out towards the end, and then the vision in chapters 10 through 11 gives us even more of a blow-up. I try to show this here. You can see how many verses are actually devoted to each topic, and this demonstrates, even if you don't agree with my identification of the kingdoms, it demonstrates that each successive vision is providing a blow up of the previous visions. So in Daniel 7, Daniel replaces the king as dreamer and sees four beasts coming out of the chaotic sea. Then in a picture of the court of heaven, one like a son of man is given the kingdom. The vision again foretells four successive human kingdoms succeeded by the kingdom of God. The vision of chapter 8 expands upon the second and third kingdoms. The visions of chapter 10 through 12 provides expanded view of events in the third and fourth kingdoms. So I don't have time to talk about this today, but I think that the end of chapter 11, 35 and following is talking about the Roman kingdom and not the Antichrist. And that's what one would expect given the four kingdoms. I don't see any reason for jumping somehow to something at the end like that. So, where are we here? I'm trying to find my notes, which seem to have disappeared. This shows chapter 9 of Daniel does not fit into this scheme at all. And I think this raises a huge problem for other interpreters. Chapters 7, 8, and 10 through 12 are concerned with the four kingdoms that end with the kingdom of God. Chapter 9 is concerned with a totally different question, and that is the end of exile. According to the context, Daniel is concerned about the end of exile. God's people had broken the covenant, and as a result, the covenant curses had fallen upon them. The final curse or judgment was exile, as we see at the end of Deuteronomy 28. Nonetheless, exile was not the last word. God had a plan from the start for his people to return, as we see in Deuteronomy 30. Isaiah indicates that the return from exile entails two separate stages. See where I don't know where this is, so let's see if we can come across it. Yes, right here. So Isaiah shows that the return from exile happens in two separate stages. Number one, return from Babylon to the land of Israel, and number two, return from covenant violation to a right relationship with God so that the covenant relationship is renewed and restored. The first stage is the physical return from exile. But as I've noted, you can get the people of out of Babylon, but how do you get Babylon out of the people? The second stage is the spiritual return of exile. It deals with the problem of sin and brings about forgiveness and reconciliation in a renewed covenant between Yahweh and his people. According to the structure of Isaiah's message, Cyrus is the agent for the return from Babylon, and the servant of the Lord is the agent for the return from sin. Thus, there are two distinct agents, and they correspond to the two distinct parts of the redemption that brings about the end of exile. So I think this is the key issue in the vision that Daniel prays about the end of exile. He reads in the Bible, in the book of Jeremiah, that the exile will be over in 70 years. God tells him it's going to take 70 sevens, which I think of as 70 sabbaticals. But the main point is getting Babylon out of the people is going to take a lot longer than getting the people out of Babylon. And this is very clear as we look now. Let's see here. Hopefully this is going to come out. I don't know where my slides are. Did we pass? Let's see. Okay, here we go. Let me just advance in this fashion to the right slide. Not scrolling down. I guess this is it totally. Yeah, that's what I want right there. So this shows you the purposes. There are six purposes that are mentioned in verse 24, three negative and three positive. Number one, to end the rebellion. Two, to do away with sin. Three, to atone for guilt or iniquity. Then there are three positive purposes. Four, to bring in everlasting righteousness. Five, to seal up prophetic vision. I understand the two words there as a nominal hendiadys. So that's why I'm translating it that way. To seal up prophetic vision. And six, to anoint the most holy person or place. It's not clear whether what's being anointed is a person or a place. When one considers the plan of redemption as outlined by Isaiah, clearly the angelic message is concerned principally not with the first stage of return from exile, but with the second stage of return from exile. The forgiveness of sins and the renewal of a right relationship to God. The end of exile is frequently portrayed in terms of the Exodus in the Old Testament. Just as God brought his people out of Egypt in that great event known as the Exodus, so now he will bring about a new Exodus in bringing his people back from exile. In fact, many aspects of the return from exile parallel the original Exodus. In Ezekiel 4, for example, the prophet is instructed to lie down on his side for 390 days for the sin of Israel, and on the other side for 40 days for the sin of Judah, in each case a day for each year. The sum of 390 and 40 is 430, exactly the length of the period of bondage in Egypt. What is being portrayed by the drama of Ezekiel is that just as there was a period of bondage in Egypt before God brought about the Exodus, so now there will be a long period of foreign overlords before he brings about the new Exodus. So I see that as a parallel passage. Outside of Daniel 9, this longer period of subjugation before the new Exodus is referred to in Daniel 8:19 as the time of wrath. Compare Zechariah 1:12, where the 70 years under Babylonian rule is described as the time of wrath. The vision of Daniel 9 communicates the same truth. From the prophecy of Jeremiah, Daniel expects a literal period of 70 years for the exile to be completed. This 70-year period apparently begins with the death of Josiah in 608 and extends to the fall of Babylon to Cyrus the Great in 539. When Daniel brings this issue to God in prayer, the answer is that the 70-year period deals only with the first stage of the return from exile. Before the new Exodus, there will be a longer period of exile. Thus, the real return from exile, a period including the forgiveness of sins, renewal of the covenant, and consecration of the temple, will not take just 70 years, but rather 77s, a much longer time. This fundamental point of the vision has unfortunately escaped the attention of proponents of both dispensational and non-dispensational treatments in the last 100 years. Although the focus of the message is on the city and the people, there are broader implications for the nations. This passage must be seen in the light of the Abrahamic and Mosaic covenants. The Mosaic covenant directed and instructed the family of Abraham as to how to live in a right relationship with God, a right relationship with one another in covenant community, and a right relationship to the earth, so that they could be the blessing to the nations. With the Mosaic covenant broken, Israel now needs the forgiveness of sins so that the covenant is renewed and the blessings can flow to the nations. Thus, the final and real return from exile is achieved by dealing effectively with Israel's rebellion. The first objective in the list of six is to end the rebellion, that is, Israel's rebellion. Then the blessing can flow to the nations. And this blessing finds fulfillment in the apostolic preaching of the cross and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, when each one of them turns from their wicked ways, according to Acts 3:26. So this is the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. In this way, the second stage of return from exile has implications specifically for Israel, but also universally for the nations. All right, I'm going to try and summarize some of the rest of what I'm doing here. I want to look at the literary structure of... I don't know that I even put this on a slide, so it may be quite problematic. I don't think I got this far. So, in the article in the book, what I show is that let me find my place here. The literary structure, Daniel 9, verses 25 to 27, is not to be read in a linear manner according to the logic of prose in the Western world based upon a Greek and Roman heritage. Instead, the approach in Hebrew literature is to take up a topic and develop it from a particular perspective. Then you shut the conversation down and you stop and you start again, taking up the same theme again, but this time from a different perspective, from a different point of view. This approach is kaleidoscopic and recursive. It is like hearing music from stereo speakers sequentially instead of simultaneously. First the music of the right speaker, then comes the music of the left speaker. Now, when you listen to two speakers, do you have the same music coming from these speakers, or do you have different music? Well, the answer is, you can have your cake and eat it too here. In one way, it's the same music, but the music from the left speaker is different slightly from the music of the right speaker. That is what gives you the stereophonic effect. The same thing happens in Hebrew literature. When you have these two conversations side by side, you actually end up with a holographic or a three-dimensional idea. So this is the way Hebrew literature works. It's based on holographic ideas, and it's not based on Aristotelian rectilinear logic, where you start from A and work towards B by means of syllogisms. Verse 25 introduces the first period of 7 weeks and the gap of 62 weeks to the climactic 70th week. This last week is described twice in verses 26 and 27. Verses 26a and 27 describe the work of the Messiah in dying vicariously to uphold a covenant with the many and to deal decisively with sin, thus ending the sacrificial system. Verses 26b and 27b show that, ironically, supreme sacrilege against the temple at this time will result in the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Thus, verses 26 and 27 have an A-B-A-B structure. This fits the normal patterns in Hebrew literature to deal with a topic recursively. The literary structure can be diagrammed as follows. I could actually just find it quickly here. Beneficial work. Let's see, you can quickly go to this. Where is the... That's all to do. There we go. What? You can just blow it up, eh? Sorry?
Control F5.
That didn't do anything, sorry.
Shift that back.
There you can see it.
Shift that back.
Okay, so I think this is crucial. So we have the beneficial work of the Messiah, and then we have in 26b the ruin or spoliation of the city by his people and its desolation by war. Then we have the beneficial work of the Messiah, Then we have 27b, abominations resulting in destruction of the city by one causing desolation. This is something that I'm going to actually, for me, is non-negotiable. I would say, and I'm not trying to be arrogant here, a lot of the treatments of this text are not based on an understanding of how Hebrew literature works. And we have to follow the rules for understanding how Hebrew literature works. Very quickly then, I'm going to summarize the rest of my presentation. The meaning of weak. I think it's important to do three things. I think it's important to connect the word weak with Daniel 10, verses 2 and 3, where we have the unique expression, a week of days. This means that the word weak in Daniel 9 is not being used in the ordinary way, and that when he gets to chapter 10, he's returning to the normal use of the word for weak. Number two, I think we have to connect it with Jeremiah 25, as verses 1 and 2 clearly show us. And that's why I think that these are 70 sabbaticals, because Jeremiah is saying that because they didn't observe the Sabbath rests, that the land will have its Sabbath rests. And I show a little diagram of the book. Basically, there's 490 years down to the exile in Babylon, which takes 70 years, and then there's another 490 years to get back into a right relationship with God. So the time required to get back into a right relationship with God is exactly the time that they took in getting out of a right relationship with God. Are they literal or symbolic? This is something that I interpreted them as literal in the book, and I'm revisiting that at the moment. So that may cause me embarrassment, but I'm not worried. I'm always interested in learning from others. Why do we break the numbers into 7, 62, and 1? Because according to this vision, most of the vision is concerned with the beginning and ending of this period of time. The beginning of the period has to do with the rebuilding of Jerusalem, and the end of the period has to do with the work of the Messiah, the Anointed One, and of the Nagi, the leader or prince. And so that, I think, is a successful explanation of why it's broken down into these three numbers. Messiah, this is where I actually started 35 years ago when I was first able to read the text. The last part of verse, the second line of verse 26, the simplest way to read this is that the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And there are two things here. The most obvious thing is to take the prince as the same prince in the previous verse. Unless you are imposing on the text a preconceived system, this is the natural way to read it. And with all due respect to Professor Miller, this chapter has nothing to do with 8, with 7, 8, or 11. So trying to connect it with those texts is irrelevant. Those are irrelevant considerations. If I had a lot of time, I would actually go through every paragraph of Isaiah 5 through 12 and show you how the prophet actually sets the immediate future against the distant future. So there's a paragraph on the immediate future, there's a paragraph on the distant future. And that's why people confuse, for example, the virgin birth predicted in chapter 7, which I take as a literal prediction of the virgin birth, and they confuse that with the events at the beginning of chapter 8. And the same thing happens in Daniel. Just because there are some similarities between chapter 9 and 7, 8, and 11 doesn't prove anything. It just proves that you've misunderstood the literary structure of the book from my point of view. So, it does in the second part, it doesn't say that there's another prince. The text does not say that. That's an assumption that's made by people who assume that this is the Antichrist. It says that the people of the coming prince are the ones who destroy the city and the sanctuary. I took one of my PhD seminars was in Josephus. I spent a whole year in Josephus. The whole reason why Josephus wrote the Wars of the Jews is to exonerate the masses by blaming the few. So in other words, everyone blamed not the Romans were not at fault for destroying the city, it was the Jews who destroyed the city. And that's why Josephus wrote the Wars of the Jews. Jason Perry has dealt with this in great detail. Just want to comment, he will confirm a covenant with the many. I think there are intertextual links here with Isaiah. You pointed out the word iniquity. The word many occurs four times in Isaiah 53 verses 10 to 12, which is badly obscured by our modern translations, translating Rabim by great and Atsumim by numerous, by mighty. Those words mean the many and the numerous. And so the idea of the one and the many actually occurs four times in verses 10 to 12. And that's the basis of Paul's study in Romans 5. So there's a link there. And I've also shown in my article when it says that that he will be cut off. But I would translate this, but not for himself, because there's clear evidence that Ain is replacing Lo in later Hebrew. And so I don't think that the interpretation he will have nothing is a reasonable translation of the Hebrew text. This is later Hebrew, and you have to translate it according to the values of later Hebrew. And that means that the death of the Messiah is an atoning death, you see, and that fits in with Isaiah 53. I'm just going to stop there and make room for questions. If you want to read every last detail that I went through, it's in print. Go ahead, Greg. Well, I haven't made up my mind on this. Zach Maxey does, and I want to think about this, is that here's a point that I didn't make, and I think this is very important. If you see the repetition structure, do you follow what I'm saying? Then after the 7 and 62 weeks, verse 27, and in the 70th week, verse 27, are actually the same thing. There are two different ways of saying the same thing. After the 69 weeks and in the 70th week are actually two different ways of saying the same thing. So a lot of people say, well, what do you have happening there? It's the Messiah that's cut off in the 70th week. The one who causes desolation is the Jewish nation, because Am is a singular noun in Hebrew. So this is not Titus, it's the Jewish nation that is causing desolation. On the wing of abominations. So the Romans are maybe doing some abominations, or the high priests are doing some abominations, but it's the Jewish nation that's responsible. How it might work if we take the years symbolically is that I would have nothing happening after the middle of the 70th week. And that leaves 3.5 years, which elsewhere in the book of Daniel and in the book of Revelation symbolizes a period of extended but limited persecution of God's people. So that is a way in which you could, if you took the numbers symbolically, you could actually include the whole church age that way, with the focus of the prophecy being on the first coming of Christ and his atoning death. Is that useful? I don't know.
So you're taking the first part literally, the last three and a half?
Well, that's what Zach Maxey did. I just need to sit down and do a lot more thinking of this, which I haven't had time to do. So, but there are.
Did you make a comment in Daniel 10 in the beginning verses about a partial basis for symbolism, days of something?
Yes.
I looked at that. I couldn't find that.
Daniel 10 verses 2 and 3.
Okay.
It says a week of days. Let me just check that. Well, the word is days in the Hebrew text, okay? Do you see that, Greg? At the very end of verse 2, 3 weeks, namely days. Do you see that? The same thing at the end of verse 3. And that is a very strong consideration that the word week in 9 is not being used in the normal way that it's used everywhere else in the Old Testament as a period of 7 days. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks.
Josephus and the rabbis of his day understood that the stone destroyed the beast. Crushed the legs of iron, the fourth kingdom of the Roman Empire. So one of the reasons there were heightened expectations for the Messiah to come on the scene at any time and destroy the Roman Empire and set up the Messianic kingdom. The problem is, the stone doesn't strike the legs of iron, it strikes the feet of the fifth kingdom. And that's when the whole thing comes crumbling down.
I don't understand your point at all. It strikes the legs of the fourth kingdom.
It strikes the feet.
The feet.
The feet. It's the fifth kingdom. So
no, it's not the fifth kingdom.
I know you're saying it's not, but think about it. Yeah,
that's your interpretation.
The legs of iron crushed the Messiah and lasted for 400 more years. But when the stone comes, he sets up this kingdom.
The Roman Empire doesn't come on the scene until about 63 BC, and that's what Daniel 11, 35 and following is referring to. So that's how I view that text.
Even though it calls it a he will make, in Daniel 11, it's talking about individual, the king will do it.
Yes, if you want, Jason Perry has written an article with all the historical details, and it's published in Jets. What year was that? 2009 or no? It was published January of 2013. So if you want to work out all of those historical details, I think that's a very and to jump to the Antichrist is totally against the structure, because when you see the telescoping nature, you start out with an overview. The second map is a blow-up, and the third map is a blow-up of the second one. You would expect it to have more to say about the group, the third kingdom, and a little bit to say about the fourth kingdom. Sorry.
Your point in Daniel 8:19 about the ramp.
Yeah.
Could that be the same ramp that John the Baptist and Paul bring up?
Expand. I'm sorry, I'm not understanding your question.
Stress
at the moment.
Daniel 8:19, the last end of the wrath, or the time appointed.
Is it the word za'am?
That I'm not sure.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you reference the Zechariah 1:12.
Well, you have the same word za'am.
Yeah, but could they be referring to that same wrath? Both John the Baptist. All in 1 Thessalonians?
Oh, I don't think that's a future wrath. I think it's the wrath of God on the fall of Jerusalem. But what would happen is, my position need not be taken as a preterist position, because it could be typological of a future wrath. But I think that the focus of the prophecy. The focus of the prophecy is on the first coming of Christ. By the way, if you believe in the unity of the scriptures, this isn't an argument that would go over well in where I was trained, but Gabriel is always associated in the Bible with announcements concerning the coming of the Messiah. And that would go against any interpretation that relates to the Antichrist. I have a funny trick. You may laugh at this, but I have two different heritages, because I'm an academic great grandson of Montgomery. My supervisor was John William Weavers. His supervisor was Henry Gaiman, and Henry Gaiman studied under Montgomery. I also studied under Harold Honer, whom we called Harold Honer back in those days. You remember that? He does. He wrote a book, a 400-page book on Herod, which... Sorry. Thank you very kindly.
All right, thank you.